I believe that now, on the eve of a new millennium, it is time to break the silence. It is time for us to say here in Beijing, and for the world to hear, that it is no longer acceptable to discuss women's rights as separate from human rights.
This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris-Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. 30 years ago, the Beijing Declaration charted a path to achieve gender equality worldwide. Since then, some progress was achieved. Girls are surpassing boys in school completion, women are gaining seats in parliament, and nearly 100 countries have scrapped discriminatory laws. But poverty, hunger, conflict, climate change, and backlash against women's rights are eroding progress and threaten to reverse the gains made in the last 3 decades. In order to gain insights into these issues, and in celebration of International Women's Day on March 8th, I'm honored to welcome to Vis-a-Vis Professor Rachel Finkelstein and Yasmin Ergas. Rachel Finkelstein is Associate Professor of Professional Practice at SIPA. She leads the Institute of Global Politics Women's Initiative and SIPA's Human Rights, Gender and Equity Concentration, along with Yasmin Ergas. Yasmin Ergas is Senior Lecturer in Discipline in International and Public Affairs and Co-Director of the Concentration in Human Rights, Gender and Equity. Rachel Finkelstein, Yasmin Ergas, welcome to Vis-a-Vis. Rachel, let me start with you and perhaps start with the year that marked the 30th anniversary since the landmark Beijing Declaration, which outlined a global agenda of women's empowerment and gender equality. On this occasion, you co-authored an Institute of Global Politics report entitled Beijing Plus 30, a Roadmap for Women's Rights for the Next 30 Years. How do you and your co-authors, Jennifer Klein and Lauren Hoffman, evaluate the progress that has been achieved so far? What are the key policy priorities that should be adopted to achieve the full and equal participation of women and girls in the next years to come? And what are the means? What are some of the levers, innovative financing, for example, or institutional reform, that should be activated?
Well, let me begin by thanking you, Emmanuel, for having me on the podcast. And of course, it's an honor to join you and to sit alongside Professor Ergas, my wonderful colleague. You rightly noted that the Beijing conference back in 1995 was truly historic. We saw in that conference the culmination of years of organizing on behalf of women's rights around the world, and the historic adoption of an ambitious platform for action agreed to by 189 nations, that really was the most far-reaching blueprint for women's rights in history. And it's still the high watermark today. Since that time, we've seen really significant progress. You mentioned some of the areas where we've seen growth in legal reform, where women organized to improve women's legal rights in over 100 countries around the world. In education, where we saw the gender gap in primary schooling virtually close on a global level, providing a generation of girls with opportunity that their mothers and grandmothers may not have had. And in health, where we saw the maternal mortality rate cut in half, showing that progress is possible when we work together as an international community to set goals. But the agenda that was outlined in Beijing, we know, remains unfinished. And in other areas, progress has really been far too slow. And I'll mention a few. First, the gap between men's and women's labor force participation over the last three decades remains virtually unchanged. Women remain dramatically outnumbered in positions of power and leadership, currently serving as heads of state in only 26 out of 193 nations, underrepresented in peace and security negotiations, notwithstanding evidence that makes clear that their participation makes peace more likely. And we know that violence against women and girls is an epidemic that continues to affect 1 in 3 women worldwide and persists in every region of the world. In addition to these gaps in the 21st century, what we highlight in the report are new and emerging challenges to women's rights that we really need to tackle if we're going to continue to make progress on the Beijing agenda over the next 30 years. And we released this report in conjunction with our partners, GWL Voices, to release this roadmap to address 4 barriers that we think are really critical to making progress in the future. The first is the need to advance democracy and human rights. We know that autocracies currently outnumber democracies for the first time in 20 years, and that nearly 3/4 of the world's population are now living under autocratic regimes. That's the highest number since 1978. And this rising authoritarianism has resulted in a systemic rollback of women's rights. So, for example, in 2024, 2 years ago, nearly 1/4 of countries reported a backlash on women's rights and gender equality in their countries. And we see policies in Russia and Hungary, for example, that incentivize women to leave the workforce, to assume unpaid caretaking roles. We see the withdrawal of nations from agreements to combat violence against women, in the case of Turkey, withdrawing from the Istanbul Convention. We see the purge of women's rights programs right here in the United States under the guise of attacking so-called gender ideology. So to advance gender equality in 2026, we really need to address the backsliding that we're seeing in democracy and relatedly in women's human rights. The second issue that we highlight is technology. The rise of technology, importantly, has generated new opportunities for women's rights, expanding education and economic participation, but it's also fueled new forms of inequality. We see that the digital gender divide remains stark around the world. Women are dramatically underrepresented in growing STEM fields, which provide high-paying occupations. Women disproportionately face gender bias in AI and technology-facilitated gender-based violence, which undermines their participation in public life. So to promote women's rights in the 21st century, we really need to secure gender equality not only offline but also online. A third area that we focus on is the need to close gaps in women's economic security and participation, including addressing the disproportionate burden of household and unpaid care work that women shoulder, which undermines their labor force participation. And we need to level the playing field for women in the economy, eliminating the laws that still exist that restrict women's access to employment, the access to property, ownership, credit. These laws and barriers undermine growth, not only for individual women and their families, but for entire economies. And then finally, we highlight the need to address gender gaps in conflict and climate response. We know that conflict is rising in the modern era, that the challenges related to climate change are growing, and that women and girls face disproportionate risks. And that women are dramatically underrepresented in decision-making tables to address these challenges. So we have highlighted that as another area that is critical to advancing gender equality in this moment.
Thank you so much. This is really very helpful, and we'll be unpacking some of these different issues that you've already highlighted. Yasmin, if I can turn to you for perhaps an assessment from your own point of view of where we are now, 30 years after the Beijing Declaration. There seemed at the time to be a very strong consensus, and it looks like this consensus is slowly eroding. Why is that the case? How much support is left towards this agenda? And do you think that part of the solution might be around coalitions that can be built in order to enable these promises, the promises made 30 years ago in Beijing.
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me along with Rachel today. I'd like to say how appreciative I am also of the summary that Rachel just gave. I think it's excellent and right on point. So what I would like to do is to distinguish between the question of specific issues and, in some ways, the more general framework. It's absolutely right. What we saw at Beijing was itself the culmination of decades of mobilization. That had had an extraordinary impact, in part because that mobilization was also within the international organizations, and because there had formed over the decades an extremely strong set of transnational social movements that carried it. So that's one thing. Amongst the things that came out of Beijing was not just an agreement on, shall we say, points of content, but also on two questions that I consider methodologically very important. The first is that the platform was largely articulated in terms of gender. And why is that significant? That has also been one of the weaknesses, or at least a point of vulnerability, because in the past decades, and there too, even during the negotiation of Beijing, and even leading up to the negotiation of Beijing, the concept of gender had attracted very passionate opposition. What was the problem? The problem was that the idea of gender seemed to open the road for a non-binary, non-natural view of the relationship between sex and life chances and the organization of social expectations. That issue has been under growing attack. Really, you can sort of look at it like a snowball. You know, I first started studying mobilizations anti-gender, I would say like in 2010, 2012, you could see parents in Italy, parents in France, demonstrating with big posters saying, no gender in schools, which then became the attack on gender ideology and so on and so forth. But there's something fundamental about the question of gender, which is that it allows you to extricate life chances and ways of being from nature or from a theologically ordained nature, however you want to see that, and ground it in social organization. If you make the distinction, and not everybody does, between your bodily sex and your ways of being, then you have to be able to talk about the social rootedness of these ways of being. And that calls into question social organization in a big way. The Beijing platform, and before that, the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, said, apertis verbis, and right at the beginning, this is not an ameliorative effort. This is a transformative effort. You can't get by fiddling at the margins. And so I think that's a very important point, that understanding that not just equality but fairness for women required a major transformation. The second thing I would say is that because it was seen in that way, Beijing repeatedly said, this is not just for individual states. This is something that in which, yes, individual states are going to have primacy and their sovereignty, and we're not casting that into discussion. However, this must be done together with the international community as a whole and with women's civil society organizations. So there was a tripartite system that was grounded. And that, I think, has also, to some extent, come under attack. As we know, international institutions are probably have expanded and become plethoric, and there is a lot of debate over their necessity of reform, which much of which I agree with. But they have also come under major criticism in terms of the legitimacy of the coordinating and directive roles that they can play. And the third thing that I would say is that the Beijing platform saw women's rights as human rights. Secretary Clinton made a statement that, I mean, I remember it. It shook the halls when she stood there and said, women's rights are human rights, and let that be known once and for all. I'm not quoting her exactly. But what does that mean? It means that the rights are not only based in your constitutions. These rights are universal rights. And that idea that there are rights that pertain to people just because we recognize them as human beings, that's under, I would say, close to catatonic today in many, many different parts of the world. So these are the sort of basic, these are basic factors. Then there was also the fact that, and I'll close with this, that this agenda really did require going into the deep holes of the mechanisms of government, of governance, of organization of society, of everything. You had to be there. You had to dig deep. You had to change at the micro level and at the macro level. And that has often failed to be realized. So where we are now is, yes, I think we can build coalitions. I think that we're in a place where maybe it's salutary that we have to come face front with the difficulties and the limitations. You know, it's one thing to be optimistic and it's another thing to be naive.
Right.
Right? And I think, yes, here is where we do have to deal with the hard realities of politics. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, this is really very helpful in setting the scene and perhaps reminding us as well that, I don't know whether this is the right interpretation, but that systemic change is also necessary in order to achieve progress. And in that light, I'd like to perhaps zero in on one particular issue that has critical consequences on the life and the potential for achievement of girls and women, Rachel, and that is the issue of child marriage. I understand that the Institute of Global Politics just released a new strategy to accelerate progress to end child marriage. Why is this issue so important today? And what is needed? What exactly is needed to accelerate action on that front?
Thank you for asking about this issue, which is critically important, not only to the human rights of individual girls, but to the health and well-being of families, communities, economies, nations. In the report, we highlight the numbers, which are quite stark. An estimated 12 million girls are married under the age of 18 each year. And of the 640 million women who are alive today who were married as children, more than 200 million were married before the age of 15. This report highlights how this practice violates the fundamental human rights, Yasmin, that you were just talking about, while denying girls the ability to make independent and consensual decisions about their lives. So why does this human rights violation matter from a strategic perspective? The report examines how child marriage not only undermines rights, but also has knock-on effects on their children, on their families. Child marriage is correlated with an increase in mortality rates, with poor health, with illiteracy, and it creates this intergenerational cycle of poverty that becomes very difficult to break. What we highlight in the report is the importance of addressing this issue in this moment, even in a moment of regression on gender equality, even in a moment where we are seeing resources reduced in terms of addressing development issues and human rights issues. We know that we are at this precipice. We, over the last two decades, have reduced the rate of child marriage from one in four girls around the world to one in five. And if we're to see that momentum continue and to see the positive development and economic benefits that flow from it, we need to act and we need to address the global shocks that have been accelerating the risks of child marriage. The report highlights a few in particular. The first is the COVID-19 pandemic, where we actually saw rates of child marriage go up. We saw reversals in the progress that took place over the last two decades, rising conflict and humanitarian crises, which we know increase risks of girls being married by their families in an attempt to preserve resources in challenging economic circumstances, even though the research tells us that that actually increases economic instability and uncertainty. Climate change, we see that as a driver, given the climate crises that are increasing and the impact that that has on poverty and economic instability. And of course, the cuts to development assistance threaten to reverse the progress that we've been seeing over these last two decades. Importantly, the report has a new analysis that we produced in partnership with the Center for Global Development that reframes this issue as not only a human rights crisis, but also as a costly policy failure. And what the report features is an economic analysis of the cost of inaction on this issue, which is put in the billions of dollars per year, which far outpaces the comparatively much smaller cost to end this practice. So the report really puts this in stark economic terms. And then it provides an actionable and evidence-based roadmap for accelerating progress on this issue over this next 15-year period, even in resource-constrained environments, by calling for doubling down on the interventions that we know have transformative potential, making big bets on girls' education, particularly at the secondary level. While we've seen so much progress in closing the gap at the primary school level in terms of gender gap, we still see significant gaps between boys and girls at the secondary school level in certain parts of the world. Doubling down on provision of health information and services, which can help prevent child marriage in the first instance. And importantly, addressing harmful social norms and working with community and religious leaders to ensure that this practice is addressed at the community level.
That's great. Thank you so much. And Yasmin, perhaps building on what Rachel just said about child marriage and the sort of widespread societal impact that it has, I'd be curious to have your view on what kind of change is both necessary and possible. In other words, does change happen in an incremental way? And therefore, you know, you basically have to work with, I don't know, civil society organizations, a number of different players who can contribute in their own way, but perhaps at a lower scale? Or do you need transformative change and therefore, you know, you need to go with, you know, radical policy changes in order to see how change trickles through society? What's the model that works best in your view and based on your own experience?
So that's a very big question, and I think actually that focusing on child marriage in a sense, you know, highlights many of the issues, because it's about the lack of autonomy of the girls, it's about their use as exchange value, it's about the consequences for them and for the families and so on and so forth. And I think what it really highlights to me is the lack of autonomy, the denial of self-determination of girls. We don't think of children as being able to make these kinds of decisions. And in fact, often these decisions are not made by them, but for them. And the consequences are beyond their control. So what is it that is transformative? But in my view, I would say, first of all, I would say, look, everything is incremental. you can't storm the Winter Palace here, right? You've got to make the changes that you can, where you can, and where women and girls are. So the first thing is understanding that. And in each society, understanding what is it that's going to have the greatest multiplier effect. In my view, one of the things that has the greatest multiplier effect is being able to ensure that women have that array of rights that I think of as habeas corpus rights, that are to do with their control over themselves and their bodies. You know, very recently, a great historian of philosophy, British, was talking about the situation of women in England in the 19th century, and he said, well, women were being, you know, berated for not having a will, but they couldn't make their wills. It's difficult to make a will if you don't have a will. We're still, in many contexts, in a place where the will of the women is only just slowly being asserted. So the fact that we now recognize in many, many countries the possibility of rape and marriage. I grew up in a context in Italy, a country in which the rule was that once you were married, you had consented now and forever, as the court said. Ora per allora. And that was that, you know. Thankfully, by the time I got married, it was no longer the case. But that was the reality. And it has been, it was the reality into well into the 20th century in the UK. It was the reality we've had discussions in the last 20 years over, are women who are married entitled to oppose their husband's sexual desires? That's part of it, in the same way as reproductive autonomy is part of it, in the same way as not being subjected to rape is part of it. Those are really, really important things. You know, and education. So in the 19th century, there was a lot of talk about how women needed to be educated and they couldn't be citizens until they were educated and so on and so forth. And Mary Wollstonecraft has eloquent passages about the inferiority of women who bat their eyelashes at men and can't think an autonomous thought. Well, and therefore the answer was education. We have to understand that education is, yes, about learning math and learning technology and learning all these things, but it's most fundamentally about learning to think for yourself and feeling entitled and empowered to do so and having the means to discuss it. So we have to think a lot about the quality of the education that the girls are getting and not just their enrollment rates, which is important, no doubt, but you know, and there we're going to get into trouble, because there we talk about what are you actually teaching them, and is that a matter that's exclusively for state sovereignty, or how are we going to navigate all of this? So, all right. So I think it's extremely complex, but I think that two things. One is you have to look for the levers and the fundamental issues, and it seems to me that self-possession is one of the most important. And that's also why economic autonomy is so important. Everything that goes into developing autonomy. The second is, I think you have to understand that you will always face backlash. When you draw a policy, you can't draw it as if it were a line, because that's not how it works. A policy is forward and back, recursive, and you have to be in those loops. You have to know that when you increase women's economic autonomy, they may get raped more, not less. And what are you going to do then? You have to have the answer to that question. So that's what I think.
Right. I mean, there's an interesting example of a policy that has actually generated some results, but I understand that now it has actually gone on the back burner. On gender-based violence as a weapon of war, which you, Rachel, mentioned earlier. Today, you know, in war-torn countries like Ukraine, Sudan, there are countless numbers of reports of rape and torture and sexual abuse. used as tactics, really, of war against citizens and particularly women. What can be done to fight this scourge? And, you know, there's a policy that you were involved in, Safe from the Start, a humanitarian initiative of the previous administration. Is that the way to achieve progress, or should efforts focus, for example, on the legal side of things and prosecuting perpetrators in the hope that that will deter future would-be abusers?
Well, the answer is both and. And this is one of the gravest violations of human rights and, frankly, of international law, the use of rape as a tool of war, which is not incidental to conflict. It is often deliberate, systematic. It's aimed at terrorizing civilians, at fracturing communities, reinforcing control through fear. And this is a scourge that's actually growing. So the UN Secretary General puts out a report on this issue every year. According to the most recent report, conflict-related sexual violence actually rose in 2024, increasing by a quarter as compared to the previous year. And as you mentioned, women and girls comprise 92% of the victims of this human rights abuse. So how should we address it? Prevention is one critical answer. And you mentioned Safe from the Start, which is a prior U.S. government program that's focused on early and sustained humanitarian action. It was created to prioritize the prevention of gender-based violence from the outset of humanitarian responses, really embedding protection into core services such as shelter, food distribution, healthcare, and sanitation. And these types of approaches reduce risks, they save lives, and really mitigate harm in the earliest and most acute phases of a crisis. So that's one answer, is prevention. And right now, as we're sitting here, there are advocates and policymakers working at the UN on a new convention on crimes against humanity, which I hope will strengthen these protections against sexual violence and conflict and place a greater emphasis on prevention. This process is still in its early stages, but I think it holds a lot of promise. So prevention's one critical answer. A second is accountability, which is indispensable. Ending impunity for perpetrators through domestic courts, through international courts, creating support for documentation efforts so that cases can be brought to ensure access to justice. That helps create accountability for this crime. And while prosecution alone will not prevent all future abuses, the absence of accountability virtually guarantees that this violation will continue. And we're seeing some signs of progress for addressing the historic impunity for this crime. So, for example, last October, the International Criminal Court convicted someone in the Darfur conflict. It was a war crimes verdict that for the first time held a conviction for the crime of gender-based persecution, including rape as a war crime and a crime against humanity. So that represents a really important moment of recognition of accountability for victims, but we know that more action is needed. And then finally, ensuring access to justice goes beyond convictions. We need to think about support for survivors themselves. That can include reparations, and there's a really innovative reparations regime that the government of Ukraine has put into place to help support survivors who experienced conflict-related sexual violence in that conflict. Access to medical care, legal assistance, economic reintegration, these elements can be really important to ensuring that survivors have access to the justice they deserve.
Mm-hmm. This is inspiring. And I want to turn perhaps, Yasmin, to a book that you wrote on reproductive decisions. The book is called Reassembling Motherhood. And you co-edited this book with Jane Jensen and Sonia Michel. And you know, you show that there has been a great deal of progress, including through technological advances on reproductive decisions. At the same time, the book shows that there are still major obstacles to reproductive freedom. I'd love to know what those obstacles are and what your view is about how they can be overcome.
Well, the obstacles, first of all, we've achieved great results on maternal mortality, but not enough. You have to understand maternal mortality as women dying simply because they're women. It's very simple and straightforward. And so our target has to be much more ambitious on that. Maternal mortality correlates with the illegality of abortion, with the difficulty in accessing contraceptive services, with everything that essentially constrains individual women's ability to control their reproduction. And so I don't know that there's much to be done other than ensure better, fairer access. That, and when I worked on a development project, one of the issues that we were acutely aware of was being able to ensure that women had the autonomy to be able to make their decision without being in the sight necessarily of other members of their community, sometimes even of their partners and so on. In other words, it's not just about making abortion legal, ensuring that when somebody has even a non-legal abortion, they can have the care that they need, which means ensuring that you don't get prosecuted when you turn up at the hospital, ensuring that the hospitals and the physicians and the hospital personnel are assured that they will not get prosecuted. As we know, in our own country, this has become far more problematic. So it's all of that, and it's understanding the cultural context. The other thing that I want to say is that maternal health is a thing in itself. In other words, you need to take care of women who are pregnant, but it's also the end product of health issues that can accumulate over a long period of time. So, you know, reproduction is going to be better when health is better, when the social conditions of having families are better. So that's why we need a multi-pronged approach. I would also say that there are many issues that are arising in reproduction that have to do partly with reproductive technologies and with new forms of reproduction, some of which expose women, can't have the potential for exposing women to new kinds of physical risks. So, for example, ova harvesting, egg harvesting on a large scale. We need much better regulation of all of that. And others of which raise real problems or questions about women's ability to control their own reproductive decision making. So, for example, what is the binding value of a contract of surrogacy? Well, this is something that we've got to discuss, that we've got to be able to figure out. It's not coincidental that the international community has been trying for more than 10 years to come up with a solution to these issues, and it hasn't. Because there is no fundamental agreement on questions like who is a mother, what are their rights, when do they end, how are we going to regulate all of this. We have to, as Rachel said when she was talking about the Beijing report, she said there are new areas, and actually reproductive technology is one of those new areas that we have to be able to go into and to talk about and to figure out what is fair for the people involved.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the issue of political representation, which you both mentioned. As you said earlier, Rachel, you know, worldwide women hold just 27% of parliamentary seats. But there are great variations, and I'm curious about the example of Rwanda, where women hold 63.8% of seats in the lower house, the highest percentage globally, I believe. They also hold about 50% of seats in the Senate. It's partly due to the decision after the genocide to adopt a 30% gender quota rule. But I'm wondering whether Rwanda in this case can offer an example other countries could follow, and particularly on the issues of quotas, because there's been a lot of debate about the efficiency or the desirability of quotas. Do you think that they work? And are there other measures that can be taken to help improve political representation of women?
I'm glad you mentioned this issue because it's critical and it's one of the areas where we've seen the slowest rate of progress since the Beijing conference. So there have been increases, but far slower than in other areas. And Rwanda is one of the few examples of countries in which women have reached parity in the legislature. And just to put that in context, there are only 9 countries out of 193 nations that have reached gender parity in their legislature. So what that means is that around the world, the vast majority of presidents, prime ministers, representatives are male. And we are facing really alarming headwinds in this moment where, in part because of the rising incidence of violence against women in public life, both online and offline, we are actually seeing globally fewer women signing up to run for office in the first instance. So why does this gender gap in leadership matter? And what explains parts of the world or countries where we've seen different results? There are a few reasons that I would point to. First, why it matters. There's really strong research that women's inclusion in leadership positions promotes democracy and stability. So women's parliamentary representation, for example, is associated with a decreased risk of civil war and lower levels of state-perpetrated human rights abuses, such as disappearances, political imprisonment, and torture. And there's one study that found that countries are almost 5 times less likely to respond to an international crisis with violence when women's parliamentary participation increases by only 5%. So that's really notable. We also know that greater women's representation in positions of political power increases support for policies to expand social welfare, investments in health, investments in education, and of course, protection for gender equality and human rights. And there have been some recent studies that have suggested that women's political empowerment is actually associated with economic growth. So there are a lot of reasons to care about this persistent gender gap in leadership around the world. So I hope I've made the case that it matters. What can we do to actually increase it? There's some evidence that does suggest that quotas and other special measures can be effective tools in closing representation gaps. So there's a study by the Interparliamentary Union that shows that countries with gender quotas had, on average, more than 31% of women in parliament in 2024, so higher than the average that you cited. And that's compared to less than 17% in countries without quotas. So we know that they can work. And we've seen in recent years countries such as Ireland, Jordan, Mongolia, Uzbekistan strengthening their quota systems and seeing corresponding gains in women's representation. So these findings confirm that quotas can be a really powerful mechanism for accelerating change. But we know that they're not a silver bullet, and we know that they are context dependent. So Rwanda is a good example of where we actually saw increases in women's political power embedded in broader political and institutional reforms. And it's important when we're thinking about representation not only to look at the numbers, but also to see if women actually have power in the positions that they hold. And so for that reason, many experts recommend pairing quotas with complementary measures that strengthen women's ability to compete for office in the first instance and to lead and govern effectively when they're there. So that means capacity building programs that help support women candidates across political parties, building the pipeline from recruitment to training to mentorship, closing the gap in access to resources to run for office. And I think it's important also to highlight social and cultural norms. We know that addressing gender bias in political coverage is important in addressing public perceptions of women's leadership. We are seeing public opinion on the ability, the perceived ability of women to lead shift over time. But these are really sticky norms. And in order to see some of these barriers shattered, we need to move cultural perceptions of women's roles in society and ability to lead effectively.
I'd like to end by asking both of you a question regarding the next generation, because you are both professors at SIPA, at the School of International and Public Affairs, and at the Institute of Global Politics at Columbia. And I'd love to know, perhaps starting with you, Yasmin, you know, when you discuss policies designed to tackle, you know, gender inequality, when you discuss these issues in class with your students, what inspires you? What gives you hope? What do you see coming out of this next generation that gives you encouragement?
I mean, the simplest answer is they do. There's nothing like watching this growth year after year of cohorts of young people for whom gender equality is really a driving concern, and who have understood that you need to pair your passion together with professional capacities. So that's the first thing that I would say. I mean, we have amazing students, and I would say today an amazing community of people, primarily women, but not only, who are really engaged every day in finding ways to work towards greater gender equality, towards greater safety for people in relation to gender, towards greater fairness for women, and so on. Second, I would say we know a lot. Now, one of the things that we didn't talk about and which we need to talk about is that part of the regression that's going on is a regression of knowledge. And we have to be careful that we are still able to have the data, that we are able to have more data, better data, to be able to formulate intelligent policies. But we do. If I think back 30 years, where we are today is, you know, incommensurable. Mm-hmm. And so that's what makes me very optimistic. I always tell my students that they are like my messages in a bottle. They come, they study, they leave, and I feel like I've thrown a bottle into the ocean, and I know that they're going to land on shore. I may not be there to see it. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, I've been doing this for many years. Mm-hmm. I get an extraordinary number of letters and emails from students whom I haven't had any contact with for years, who say, you changed my life, your course changed my life, the work that I'm doing now would have been unthinkable without what I learned at SIPA. And so that's obviously a cause for optimism.
Yeah, which justifies the idea that knowledge is of the essence. Rachel, what's your view?
Well, I am optimistic not only because of the impatience of the students in my classroom and their determination to fight for change, but also because of their innovation. And I had the good fortune of traveling around the world, interviewing students and activists at the height of the global Me Too movement in preparation for a book I wrote called Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights. And what I learned was that the innovative approaches of students and advocates and activists on the front lines of social change, they are changing the way that gains are won, and they are transforming the debate. It was really incredible to see millions of women of all races, ethnicities, classes, religions, across country lines coming together to defy cultural expectations of shame and silence, and to use 21st century online tools to demand change. They ignited not only a global conversation and movement, but we are still seeing laws and policies that are changing as a result of that online transnational activism that students and young people largely led. During earlier eras, we saw that victories like this were won only after lifetimes of organizing, right? It took decades of organizing to get to that historic Beijing conference in 95. Today, thanks to advances of technology and the innovation of students and young people on the front lines, we can see the mobilization of a movement in the matter of weeks or even days. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Wonderful. Rachel, Yasmin, thank you so much for a very enjoyable conversation. You've given us a great deal to think about, but also you've given us hope that there are some pathways for change and progress on women's participation and women's rights worldwide. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Fogelstein is an expert on domestic and global policy to advance gender equality. Most recently, she served in the Biden administration as deputy director and special assistant to the president at the White House Gender Policy Council and special advisor on gender at the White House National Security Council, leading efforts on health and reproductive rights, economic security, democracy and political participation, gender-based violence, and education and humanitarian relief, among other issues. Yasmin Argas is currently on leave from SIPA and is Senior Emil Noll Fellow at the Jean Monnet Center of NYU Law School. Among her many contributions to Columbia, Yasmin Argas co-founded the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies of the university and is a member of the Executive Committee of the Committee on Global Thought, as well as of the Academic Advisory Board of the Institute on Global Politics. Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris 1 Panthéon Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Rachel Kahn and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Esther Jackson and her colleagues at Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.